Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. So here we are. It is the day of reckoning for what feels like an interminably long and rancorous campaign season. So long and so divisive that it's exposed deep fissures within the American electorate, which will not likely be smoothed over after the results are tallied, especially since the traditions and legitimacy of our democracy have been called into question, even threatened in ways unprecedented in recent memory, but not in American history. For some perspective, we're turning to Brady Carlson, late of NHPR, now All Things Considered host at Wisconsin Public Radio, and forever the author of Dead Presidents, an American adventure into the strange deaths and afterlives of our nation's leaders. Brady, so great to have you with us again.
So great to be back with you, Virginia.
So a lot of people are saying that this election is unprecedented. It's never been so contentious, so ugly, and the country's so divided. Is that true?
I would just point to an election in which one party referred to the other as having been the pimp for the Tsar of Russia.
Woo!
The other party accusing that candidate of being an adulterer and mass murderer. We are certainly in unprecedented times in some ways, but to say that this is the most contentious election of all time, hardly.
When was that?
That was in 1828 between Andrew Jackson, he was the one they called the mass murderer because he had fought plenty of duels, and John Quincy Adams, who was the sitting president at the time but had been the U.S. minister to Russia and knew the Tsar, and I guess the Jackson people thought, well, then he must have been procuring lady friends for the Tsar.
Wow. Always back to Russia, huh?
It always comes back to Russia. It's a theme.
So it's either been, as some people call it, a dark carnival of an election or just one that's complicated and always changing. We've had the rise of outsider candidates, Bernie Sanders, Donald Trump, that incited a lot of contempt for the Electoral College system and raised the possibility of contested conventions. Now the fairness of that system is being again raised. So bring us back to that rationale for the Electoral College system, which of course leads to
Hamilton, because all roads lead to Hamilton. Essentially, the founders wanted to put some distance between the masses who they felt at that time were not as well read, not as well educated, and therefore too prone to being swayed by the feelings of the moment, that they would sort of chase after something that they would regret later on. And so originally the idea was that the people would only indirectly choose presidents by picking these electors who then would be wise and respected members of the community who would choose the president themselves. That was the idea anyway. And It was set up in that each presidential elector would get two votes. The top vote getter would become president. The runner-up would become vice president. The issue in one of the earliest elections in 1800 was that we had had the rise of political parties proposing a slate of candidates for president and vice president. And the electors for one of those tickets was so disciplined that they actually wound up giving the same amount of votes to their presidential candidate, Thomas Jefferson, and their vice presidential candidate, Aaron Burr. Now, the Constitution said at that time, as it does now, when there's no majority in the Electoral College, the House of Representatives chooses the new president. And at that time, there was enough support for Aaron Burr, or at least opposition to Thomas Jefferson, to keep the House from choosing an outright majority. And so it took the House 6 days, 36 ballots, before they eventually did choose Jefferson. And depending on which histories you read, one of the main reasons that Jefferson won and Burr lost was the intervention of Lin-Manuel Miranda. Oh. I mean, Alexander Hamilton.
He was around then?
He was around back then, and he was putting out those great rhymes. Hamilton was lobbying for Jefferson, who was his longtime rival. Said essentially he was the lesser of two evils because he very much disliked Aaron Burr. And I guess Aaron Burr kind of proved him right a few years later.
Wow, so a lot of parallels. But still, this points to it not really being an election for the voice of the people. It's those that know better.
And sometimes it's even gone further. I mean, there have been plenty of examples in American democracy, for all of its high ideals, where we have had vote buying and fraud and nefarious business of all different kinds. Let's also remember that for decades and decades in the early days of the country, that only a select few of people could vote at all, even for those electors. Women couldn't vote. People of color couldn't vote. Many white men who didn't own property couldn't vote. Those barriers have come down. But, I mean, we come out of a democratic tradition that in its earliest days, in the colonial period, George Washington himself spent time as a candidate for Virginia's House of Burgesses trying to buy votes with huge amounts of liquor that he distributed out to his potential supporters. So that's part of our democratic tradition, too.
Okay, so let's go back to this. The Constitution says when there's no majority in the Electoral College, the House of Representatives chooses the next president. Of course, within recent memory, the Supreme Court chose the new president. But has this happened? Any elections that get thrown to the House?
It did happen one other time in 1824, and this one's a little less complicated. Essentially, there were enough candidates that had regional support that nobody won an outright majority in the Electoral College that year. This was a pretty high-profile set of candidates. John Quincy Adams, he was the son of President John Adams. He was the sitting Secretary of State at the time. Andrew Jackson, the hero of the War of 1812. And Henry Clay, who was a great legislator and Speaker of the House at the time. Now, Andrew Jackson finished first, but he didn't have a majority. That's why it went to the House. And overseeing that House voting was Henry Clay, who had a lot of sway about who was going to end up as the next president. The House wound up choosing John Quincy Adams, who had finished second place over Jackson as the next president. And then John Quincy Adams chose as his new Secretary of State Henry Clay. So Andrew Jackson is convinced that he finished first in this election, no matter whether it was a majority or not, that Clay and Adams had struck a sort of corrupt bargain to cheat him out of being the next president of the United States. So Team Jackson, in the aftermath of this election, began a four-year effort to essentially oppose the Adams administration at every turn, with the hopes of electing Jackson president in 1828. And that's exactly what happened.
We're talking with Brady Carlson, author of Dead Presidents, about America's history with controversial, contested, and messy elections. Is there one election that stands out as, you know, the most controversial, the worst, most contested, contentious ever?
The messiest of all time, for my money, is the 1876 presidential election, the most controversial one of all. It's largely forgotten today because the candidates in that race were very forgettable. The Republicans chose Rutherford B. Hayes of Ohio, a compromise candidate, not the most charismatic guy in the world. The Democrats chose Samuel Tilden of New York. And here's what happens. Tilden wins the popular vote, although we should say that vote was full of irregularities, including voter intimidation by Southern Democrats. Tilden wins the popular vote, but is one electoral vote short of the presidency. Hayes was even further behind in the Electoral College, but Republicans disputed the results in three states, each of which essentially wound up with two sets of election returns. To settle this, Congress sets up a special commission to decide which results are the official valid results. The final membership of that commission consists of 8 Hayes-supporting Republicans and 7 Tilden-supporting Democrats. Can you guess who won?
Let me guess who won.
So Hayes, who was himself an honest guy, ended up as the winner of this very controversial election. And because of the accusations that it was a stolen election, the opposition called him Rutherfraud B. Hayes because of how he ended up as president. In exchange for winning the election, the Republicans made a deal with Democrats that the Democrats would no longer contest the results of the election as long as the Republicans agreed to remove most, if not all, protections for African Americans in the South. So this 1876 election may be forgotten, but it did pave the way for the Jim Crow era and many of the difficulties that would come in the American South.
Okay, how about the closest ever election?
One of the closest, in popular memory anyway, other than the Al Gore George W. Bush election, was in 1960. John F. Kennedy was the popular Democratic senator from Massachusetts, but he was running against Republican sitting Vice President Richard Nixon. And there wasn't a whole lot of difference in substance policy-wise. There was a lot of agreement on many of the big issues of the day. And so as a result, it was a very close election, maybe 100,000 votes or so, splitting the two candidates. Here's the key point. Because it was so close, there was a lot of rumors that the Democrats had rigged the vote in Kennedy's favor in crucial states like Illinois, where Richard J. Daley was the mayor, and Chicago has that reputation of being the city where even the dead vote early and often. So Nixon apparently believed some of these stories and considered calling for recounts or legal challenges. And there were some attempts to do that at some point. But in the end, Nixon very publicly said, "I will not challenge the results of this election." Depending on who you believe, he did it because he wanted to make sure that the democratic process endured and was strengthened. And other people say that Nixon decided not to challenge the election because he didn't think he would win the challenge. Either way, Kennedy was making light of these rumors when people suggested that his dad, the wealthy politician Joe Kennedy, had been buying votes on his behalf. John F. Kennedy joked that he had gotten a telegram from his dad that said something to the effect of, "Buy as many votes as you need, but only as many as it takes to win, because I'll be damned if I pay for a landslide."
Well, so you mentioned, of course, the 2000 vote. This was Bush, which ended up in a Supreme Court case, Bush v. Gore. And I think a lot of people are thinking about that now, just because there has been talk until very recently about the possibility of the election being rigged. There's a lot of anxiety or some kind of national PTSD that we're all sinking back to. What was the legacy of that 2000 election?
I think what it reminds us of is that how you conduct an election can have even an unintended effect on what happens in the results of that election. The way that you design a ballot, and people who remember the 2000 election remember that famous or infamous butterfly ballot where the names of the candidates were on one side and the actual line where you would poke the hole for the candidate you were supporting was on a different side of the ballot. Mm-hmm. I mean, people will sometimes misunderstand how you cast a vote for someone, and they may actually vote for someone they didn't mean to. Some states will have paper ballots. Some use electronic machines that don't have a paper record, and people will get concerned whether there's any evidence of rigging or fraud or hacking or even just plain mechanical failure. People will get concerned, is my vote being counted in the way that I want? You'll also hear people say that, with the rise in early voting, are those ballots being secured in a way that makes me feel comfortable? I'm not saying that there's evidence of vote rigging or a problem with election security. I'm saying that in an era where people increasingly distrust institutions and in an era where states are conducting elections in very, very different ways. You have a state like New Hampshire where everybody has to vote on election day for the most part. And you have other states where people can vote by mail and that everybody gets the chance to have that ballot and just mail it in. People start to ask themselves those questions of how comfortable do I feel about this election? And I mean, anytime that a president who lost the popular vote winds up winning the Electoral College and winning the presidency, people start to say, hey, what's with that system?
Right. And the question of faith in the system, which, of course, we've heard a lot about in the last couple of weeks, especially threats from a former Trump campaign staffer of a bloodbath if he loses, even a former congressman, saying calls to arms if Trump loses, and certainly from his supporters. Has there been any precedent in American history of threatened armed resistance after by the losers of a past election, or has it ever happened?
This has happened repeatedly. It happened several times during the 1850s. This is in the period just ahead of the Civil War. This is a period where tensions between North and South, especially over slavery, have become increasingly heated, and you're seeing violent fights break out between members of Congress in the Capitol. And in 1852, which is when New Hampshire's own Franklin Pierce is elected, and then 4 years later in 1856, when James Buchanan of Pennsylvania was elected, there were some veiled and somewhat not so veiled threats by Southerners saying that we will leave the country and we might defend ourselves. There might be an armed insurrection storming the Capitol. That was all tamped down because the pro-slavery contingents favored candidate wound up winning. But it became clear as the 1860 election drew nearer that the anti-slavery candidate, Abraham Lincoln of the new Republican Party, was likely going to win. And the tension grew and grew and grew. And Southerners said, if that abolitionist from the North winds up winning the White House, off we go. And if it means civil war, then it means civil war. And we all know what came next.
Well, Brady, I guess this whole American democratic experiment, 240 years on, think it's working out?
Wasn't it Ben Franklin who said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others?
I guess this is the one we've got.
We'll take it.
Brady Carlson, All Things Considered host at Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a little tear right there for that one. And we're hanging on to him as our All Things Presidential Historian. He's author of Dead Presidents, An American Adventure into the Strange Deaths and Afterlives of Our Nation's Leaders. Brady, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Much more in the book at wordofmouthradio.org.